Marshall here. Welcome to the Thanksgiving weekend edition of RE Something Interesting, my new Saturday podcast dropped on the Realignments feed. With these episodes, my aim is to speak with interesting people about work and ideas that don't quite fit into the Realignments weekday policy and politics theme. Speaking of themes, today's episode with Doug Melville perfectly fits the post-Thanksgiving weekend with its focus on family and ancestral history. Doug's book is Invisible Generals, Rediscovering Family Legacy and a Quest to Honor America's First Black Generals. I learned about the Tuskegee Airmen, the first black military pilots during World War II, back when I was growing up. Doug wrote about them because his relations, Benjamin O. Davis Sr. and Jr., were not only America's first black generals, but they helped build and lead the unit itself. As I speak pretty frankly about in the episode, as an adopted kid struggling to find my place in black and white culture, and with my own question marks about my ancestry, I found Doug's exploration to be really compelling. I also note that as the U.S. military goes through its own struggles with race and identity during the 2020s, exploring how we solved and addressed these issues during previous eras of cultural tumult is incredibly useful. You can find Invisible Generals at our bookshop linked in your podcast show notes. A quick note, even though the show took Thanksgiving off, I'll be back with our next Supercast Ask Me Anything episode tomorrow. So if you'd like to take a full listen to that episode, submit your own questions, and support the show, go to realignment.supercast.com. Doug Melville, welcome to RE Something Interesting.
Marshall, my bro, thank you so much for giving me the time today to come on your platform and meet each other and be a part of your conversation with your listeners.
Here is why I'm desperately interested in this book. So as people don't know, my name is Marshall Aaron Kozloff. That is not the name that a African-American man of the 1990s is likely to get. That is because I'm adopted. My white parents obviously put a lot of thought into adopting a black kid. So for example, the Marshall in my name is named after Thurgood Marshall, first black Supreme Court justice. But crucially, the story of the Tuskegee Airmen was really key in our household. We grew up on the Lawrence Fishburne HBO version from 1995. We, in my living room back in Oregon, have like a painting of Red Tails that they got at the Air and Space Museum. And this is how weird my parents are. They got a 2012 Honda Fit and they named the license plate Red Tail 2. So I'm really just exposing.
Come on.
Yeah, like if your publicist really found like the person who was best prepped to have this conversation with you. So that's just why I was so interested in this story. But like, let's just kind of like jump into it, given all that context. Why are the Tuskegee Airmen relevant to you and your story?
Yes, the story of the Tuskegee Airmen was a story that I actually came to a little bit later in life. Benjamin O. Davis Jr., who is the commander of the Tuskegee Airmen, is my great uncle, and he raised my dad from the time he was seven. So in my household, he was really more of a grandfather because I was his great nephew by blood. But in our house, he was the one grandparent that I had alive. And he was the one who was the center of the family that, you know, bought me my first car, a Honda Accord, and got me my first set of golf clubs so I could do activities that he felt would be helpful for me. He bought me my first Apple II computer and he paid for my college. So he was the man that wanted to provide through education and resources, not for fun or vacations or anything like that, because he was really serious and stern and he really knew what he wanted. But that was my introduction to the Red Tails, but it was a very personal family introduction. And when I grew up, I knew he was in the military because people would always salute him, but I didn't actually know what he did. You know, he had no military in the home. It was more feng shui because he had spent a lot of time stationed over in Asia. Mm-hmm. And he talked about politics and looked out the window in Arlington, Virginia at airplanes, because that was the apartment he wanted to look out at airplanes every day, but didn't really know anything about what he did. And in 1998, when he got his fourth star from President Bill Clinton, that was the first time that I actually met Tuskegee Airmen and was introduced into the story. And then later on, when I went to go see the movie Red Tails, and of course I did watch the Lawrence Fishburne classic Tuskegee Airmen, but when I went to go see the Red Tails, that was when I was very familiar with the story because I had read about it. And that was my surprise when his name was changed as a character in the movie.
And this is the key setup point. When I read the pitch for the book and the mention of the character name change, my initial reaction was, oh, come on, not come on aggressive. That happens sometimes. Like if it turned out that there's this background character and the name's a little different, that's not a big deal. But he was played by Terrence Howard, who was pretty much at the height of his Terrence Howard. You know, he obviously gets replaced in Iron Man 2, but Empire is still coming down the line. He's at the height of Terrence Howard fame, and the name was changed then. So this is just a centerpiece of this story. So I'd love for you to tell the story of how you met Oprah at like a VIP screening of the film when it was still 3 months out from release, what you said to her about how strange it felt for the name to not be the name that he actually had.
Yeah, so this was my first time, you know, even though I had worked in entertainment, this was actually the first time I had been so involved, you know, personally in a project. You meet people on red carpets and things of that nature, but never had I actually, you know, been invested in a movie where the man, Terrence Howard, looked just like Benjamin O. Davis Jr. So you knew it was him. He was the colonel. So his rank was the same. So you knew it was him, but it wasn't his name. And afterward, after the screening, we were some members of the family, particularly me, because it was the general's family. Even though he wasn't a general in the movie, they usually address our family as the general's family. And they moved me in a room, and it was a private meet and greet to meet Oprah Winfrey. She was, you know, the largest name at the event, but also wanted to meet certain people who came in for it. And they pull us aside, and we start having a conversation, and I'm enamored because she's also at the height of Oprah Winfrey, you know, like, show me the, you know, you get a car, you get a car. So like, you know, this is Oprah Winfrey. I mean, untouchable, don't know where to find these celebrities, you know, cause they're so, you know, elusive in the world. And we start having a conversation, and as she's speaking to me, all I could think about was someone in this room changed the name. So I asked her, you know, thank you so much, but you know, but the name were changed. And then she sits to me and goes, Doug, we all came here tonight on a celebration. And the story is about inspiration, and it's an amalgamation of the characters. So actually the Red Tails movie is not based on actual real Tuskegee Airmen. It's three or four stories per character. And, you know, Doug, this is Hollywood, and this is George Lucas, and this is how it is. And everyone here came to support it, you know, like it was very matter of fact, because that's how the system works. And I think when I heard that, the rest of the party went on that night, and I started asking other people, did you change, you know, what did you think about the names? Most people didn't notice, and no one really knew who changed the names, you know, because I kept saying, how do you know who changed the names? But you know, I wasn't familiar with the reshoots and everything. I just knew that right then someone in this room changed these names. And the actual living Tuskegee Airmen were in the room. So I just couldn't imagine why all these people were invited to an event to watch a movie about them. And then when they go see the movie, their names were not the same as their lived experience. So I was missing kind of the inspiration part, and I was looking for the accuracy part. I went home that night, and I, you know, went back and, the next day to Connecticut, and I asked my dad about it, and my dad said, Doug, if you think the names are the worst thing that someone can change or affect your life, you know, you're greatly mistaken. And then we got into a whole nother discussion about it, but that was how I originally spoke and met with Oprah Winfrey and others at the party. And that was really the moment where I said, you know, something about this didn't sit well with me, not negative because I'm optimistic, but something wasn't working for me.
Yeah, and I think it actually gets to the literal title of the book, which is Invisible Generals. I think the part that is frustrating for me, because look, like I work in the defense and foreign policy space. I literally host a podcast at a think tank called The Arsenal of Democracy. So I'm obsessed with World War II at a day job level. And if we think of so many of the iconic images of World War II, by definition, they are white, like even like white plus, right? Because we could have a debate about whether or not like Italian Americans were fully within the white umbrella during the World War II era. But in modern terms, it's white. If you're watching Band of Brothers, you know, at the end of Band of Brothers, where, or at the beginning of every episode, they have like the actual members of Easy Company who are still alive, like giving a quick version of that story. Like, by definition, those paratroopers aren't black, because the army was not only segregated, but you didn't have black men in combat roles in the same way. So it definitely feels unjust, considering that history, to not just use the names, especially when little less than, you know, a little more than 10 years before Lawrence, in the Lawrence Fishburne version, he actually had his proper name. So it's not as if this was this crazy, unprecedented thing.
That was
thing.
The other thing too, you know, and the thing is, knowing that they fought in a war where they were overlooked and all they fought for was their family names, because this is kind of how it was taught to me, is that we fought for our names and the value and our dignity that we brought. So knowing that that was what they fought for, I thought that would be a no-brainer, but that was the tipping point for me to actually take action. Because if you're going to, you know, notice something, then you need to do something, or, you know, move on.
Yeah. Let me just ask you a personal question. And I'm asking you this incredibly frankly, because I want listeners just to understand where I'm coming from on this. So because I grew up in a white Jewish household, in Portland, Oregon, of all places. So neither black nor Jewish in terms of the actual, usually when people met me for the first time, I was the first Jew and the first black person they'd really spent a lot of time with in the suburbs there. I don't quite know how black people think about and consider World War II. You know, because there's this like the joke, they're like, oh, like when you turn 30, I just turned 31. The joke is, oh, you become obsessed with World War II and you're into all this different stuff. Like, but that's kind of like a very like white suburban storyline. Like, how does the black community, from your perspective, think about World War II, given the awkward history that we're talking about here?
I just think that the narrative around World War II is just, I keep watching things that talk about blacks in World War II as if there was a general omission of their efforts, because there's so many things that are so focused on blacks in World War II, blacks in World War II. But most blacks, you know, and this kind of goes into the story of Ben Sr. and Ben Jr. was, okay, Ben Sr. became an officer in 1901. And the next American to become an officer that was black was Ben Jr. in 1936. So just by that definition of that time, if you weren't an officer, you couldn't be in charge of anyone. So the 1 million blacks plus that were in the military during World War II had something that Ben Jr. would refer to as pick and shovel jobs: build railroads, do heavy labor, construction, telephone pole placement, you know, every single cook in every single mess hall in every single unit during World War II was black. You know, there's so much data on this. So I can tell you that if black Americans judged World War II by the jobs that they were tasked to do, that would already be second class through and through. Then you had the Tuskegee Airmen, which were 15,000 people in a 100% segregated Air Force that were commanded by Ben Davis Jr. And the Tuskegee Airmen got approved to be created through FDR hiring or appointing Ben Davis Sr. as the advisor to Negro policy in the military, and asked him what would be the best way for me to win the vote in the next election of black Americans. Because at that time, most blacks were voting for Abraham Lincoln, due to the freedom of the slaves and the Emancipation Proclamation. So when he said you have to provide equal opportunity for all blacks in the military, that needs to start with pilots, which were the most exclusive of all of the jobs and the roles in the military. So pilots was the premium role and the premium responsibility in the military. And the military was the largest company. If the military was a corporation, it would have been the largest in America. So the Tuskegee Airmen were literally a carve out to show equality. But then there was not much in the middle. And then you had the pick and shovel jobs. And I think sometimes when we talk about these things, Marshall, we kind of go through the nuance or use the generality, but you have to actually look at, you know, things in almost quadrants or pieces, because you can't just say, well, all this, all that. You have to really understand, well, how could there be a group up here, then no one all the way down here, and then all pick and shovel? But then you realize, oh, because they needed to have a visual representation of equality. So they built a segregated unit, held it to a different standard. And the crazy part about it was the parts from the white airplanes couldn't be used on the black airplanes. The people fixing the mechanics of the white airplanes weren't legally allowed to fix the black airplanes. So you had the Tuskegee Airmen, but this is to me why the Invisible General story is so important, because if it isn't for Ben Davis Sr., who was an officer in 1901 in a segregated military being advised to win an election, and if he doesn't have his son as the only other black officer in the entire United States who had graduated West Point, who wanted to be a pilot, it actually couldn't have even come together, because there's no way that the system would have allowed it.
I think this is this kind of gets into your day job in the DEI space, but I'm reading your family's history, and there's the personal version of the story, but there's a fascinating structural reality to everything that's happening here. So for example, Benjamin Sr. is a Buffalo Soldier. So he's a cavalryman out in the West towards the end of the Indian Wars. Crucially too, this is also a part that many people don't know about history. When Theodore Roosevelt storms San Juan Hill during the Spanish-American War, crucially, there are also Buffalo soldiers who storm that hill as well too. Key point being, during this early 1900s periods, there were actually a bunch of opportunities for even segregated Black units. Spanish-American Wars, Benjamin Sr.'s deployed to the Philippines, obviously the American colonial experience, and then, of course, the Indian Wars. But then, because after World War I, America basically retrenches, you have 25 years or so where nothing happens. Like Dwight D. Eisenhower is stuck as a major for 16 years because no one's moving up. So if Dwight D. Eisenhower cannot move up, that is obviously an environment where there are basically going to be no additional Black officers. There aren't going to be opportunities to distinguish oneself. So just like kind of talk about, because that's just like how, once again, I'm reading this as like a policy person, but I'm like, this is actually how that looks when we interpret that period through these. And what's kind of funny is, like, if you actually think about the articulation that I just gave, obviously there's racism in the segregation story you told there, but the story that I'm telling is like, look, there just weren't any wars. There weren't opportunities. You couldn't advance. So there's like both purposeful, and then there's just like de facto realities just kind of happening here. I'd love to hear, that's my reaction to your family's history. I'd love to just hear what you think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the structures were set up in a way that there's so many checks and balances. You know, I start off the story talking about Ben Davis Sr.'s father, Lewis Davis, who worked with General Logan, who was Ulysses S. Grant's best friend. And the family story really starts there, because if he doesn't work for General Logan, and if he doesn't have the ability to meet Ulysses S. Grant, and if his family isn't part of the circle, he doesn't get William McKinley to give him the signature for the elevation in 1901. So
from enlisted to officer is the key.
Exactly.
Thing.
Exactly. And what I'm saying is the structure is so important to this, because the military is a structure, and it's, you know, who can follow directions, how do structures work, how do you move in sync, how do you, you know, everything is a system, a memo, and a structure. So people learn how to take commands, people learn how to be leaders and give commands, but no one will look at the military as unstructured. I mean, this is probably one of the most structured institutions in the world.
Yeah.
So if the structure doesn't allow horizontal movement because it's so vertical, then it's very hard for groups that have not been included in the vertical feeding patterns to really get a chance to be successful. And that, to me, was the superpower of this story, was these two men said, we're going to wait it out. We're going to work together. And the saying that they would always tell me is, you have to use the system to defuse the system. This, if my family had a motto, it is use the system to defuse the system. Standing on the outside, complaining, you know, doing anything else, there is a place for it in the overall narrative of change. But the feeling in our family was the most effective way to create evolution and change is to use the system to defuse the system. If you're not part of it, you can't get the policy made to change it. So every voice is not a vote, but first you have to get in the system, build your voice. Once you build your voice, you build political capital, then you build the opportunity to vote. Once you get a vote, now you can make change through performance. But they had to get in first. And that's the part that kept the system the way it was the entry point to the vertical success pattern that you would need to climb up the ranks to become general.
Something I'm curious about, right? I'll put on my most like left-leaning hat and basically say, from my position in the, you know, mid-2020s, I agree with everything you just said. What would you say to someone who found that message deeply unreassuring during, let's say, the 1920s, right? Because like, and we'll get into this history in a second, but yeah. your family and, you know, Lewis Patrick Henry Davis, at least post-Civil War, are not a family of Black sharecroppers in the South. That's actually, I love the way you articulate that part of the story. We'll get into that in a second, but like you are speaking to that quick sliver of a Black middle class that was able to sort of screech in last mm-hmm. second between Reconstruction and like the institution of Jim Crow. So like, that's a key part here, but so many people didn't really make it in there. So like, what would you just say to people who are basically stuck waiting during the 1920s?
My dad would always tell me that, you know, because my dad was there and it was his lived experience, stories that he would tell me was there was actually at the time a lot of Blacks that resented Ben. A lot of Blacks resented the Davises because they were some looked at as token Black visual representation of equality. Some felt that all the opportunities went with them once they got in the system. Some felt that they were given unfair opportunities that were way beyond what Blacks should earn at that time. And it wasn't always a perfect relationship because the opportunities were so limited that whoever had the opportunity just by position of placement could be looked at as the quote-unquote enemy because the quote-unquote field was full and there wouldn't be any opportunities for other people to enter because of the Davises. So, you know, I can only imagine when you don't really know who's on your team and who's against you in a social structure, but that was to me the genius of what they did, particularly Ben Jr., because he had to navigate right in the middle of this, you know, the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. I mean, he's right in the middle of this and he has to keep his cool. He has to be a pilot, but also be a, you know, a diplomat in many ways. He had to be a politician. He also had to be a mechanic. He had to, you know, he had to do so many things well, and his room for error was so limited that it is shocking to me that he was able to literally move horizontally when necessary and vertical when necessary to get through the system. And I think that was my biggest takeaway, was anyone in theory could do something, but to do it in actuality was done by only really him at that time. And the information he had was given to him from his dad, and the information he had was given to him from his dad, which is why I say the generational collateral is so important to get through a system, because you have to almost have that as rocket fuel to drive you through to your goals and your expectations.
You know, and this is where being adopted, this is a tough book, not a tough book, because it's a well-written book and it's enjoyable, but it's tough to read those segments of the book, because like as an adopted person, the only generational inheritance I have at a literal level is the knowledge that my birth last name is Beckham. So obviously not Kozloff. And like, obviously Beckham is the definition of a name you would get if you were the descendant of slaves, but that's all I kind of really know. So I think in your case, it's just so cool out of a genealogical perspective. Mm-hmm. You can just like chart these things. You can go to the Army War College and read the will that was given from father and said all those different features. Something I want to talk about, because I referenced this a little bit ago, was—
I did want to say this, Marshall. One thing I did want to say just on that point is, that is true in one way, but I think you do inherit the generational collateral of the family that adopted you, because that is your family, and their generational collateral that they built up was accumulated to power you. So I think it could be looked at as biological, but like I talk about my dad as a nephew, he got the collateral that they had accumulated because of the relationship that they had sought between Ben Jr. and the son he always wanted. So I would look at it how you looked at it. I would just put a little bit more prism on it and say, you still are driven by your family and their generational collateral, just through the situation is your generational collateral, because they are your mother and father.
You know, that's actually— thank you. A, that's what I needed to hear, but B, I think that gets to a bigger point about how, especially like in the 21st century, when we're like reconceiving, like what family means, like what patterns look like all these like societal expectations are different, changing in different ways. Like, we should be aware of the fact that we don't have to just define things in the like black and white way that I kind of like set up the assumption with. So that's really well stated. So a big thing I'm really curious about, because once again, this, the way you tell the story in the book, the Red Tail's name is omitted. You start on a broader journey, like looking into your family's history and exploring and finding the story. And what you're really discovering is the story of the family of Lewis Patrick Henry Davis, the household servant who was with General Logan. Now, and this is the key thing, especially for the DC residents and the Bostonians who are listening. When you hear General Logan, you should think of Logan Circle in DC. You should think of Logan Airport in Boston. Like, this is not one of those random Civil War brigadier generals who no one ever remembers. This is a deeply important person. And like Lewis Patrick Henry Davis, like literally finds himself in the inauguration carriage of then President Grant. He then is able to get a position in the U.S. federal government, not making that much, but enough to kind of enter the black middle class. I would just love to hear from you. Mm-hmm. When you hear this story of this like 1870s period where your family is able to make it through that quickly closing door, I guess, what does that make you think about the opportunities that weren't furnished to other people? That seems very trite and very obvious, like, oh, if only everyone had gotten all of the opportunities they have. But it's just amazing how not an incredibly high salary in the federal government was enough for him to purchase a house in DC and enter the middle class. It was enough to teach his son how to read, which is how his son goes from being an enlisted soldier to an officer pretty quickly. Because even then, if you're black, if you're white, there were reading and writing challenges. So it's just crazy to me that when we think of the fact that the federal government went on to be segregated under Woodrow Wilson, so many opportunities were just actually cut out. I think it's easy to kind of look at the world we live in today and kind of say to ourselves, well, you know, America has a long, complicated racial history. It was kind of inevitable this way, but it's just crazy to read your story and hear like, wow, this could have been replicated 100 times over. that could have been extended to people 1,000 times over, and just kind of imagine the possibilities for an alternative society.
You know, Marshall, what's so interesting about that point is when I found out this story, and we were going through the information a little bit later on my learning journey, when I was looking at when Ben graduated from West Point in 1936, if you go to the Schomburg Center in New York, there's over 500 Black newspapers that existed during segregated media.
Mm-hmm.
The top five names mentioned, Ben Davis, if they were one person, not two, would be the top five names mentioned as a collective of all these 500 newspapers over all these years. The reason I bring this up is because there was two literal Americas. So I don't know how many people actually lived in Black middle class and how many people America had that were Black Americans that were able to live in a world, in a society where they felt middle class, empowered, and positive in their relationships with their neighborhood, with their community, with their faith. So it's hard for me to really say how many there were. There could have been thousands more for sure. But this is part of the end of the book, when I ask yourself to be your own, how to create visible general, how to be a visible general and go back and find your legacy, is I want people to start asking the question to see how many of these stories and families existed. Because we just don't know, because the narrative is so skewed towards the mainstream newspapers. But even when I found out there was 500 Black newspapers, I said to myself, how could there have been 500 Black newspapers? We don't even know about it. But that's the thing that was so tricky about this time. The man that was written up one time in Time magazine, mm-hmm. and is completely invisible to essentially the white world of media and coverage, et cetera, is also at the same exact time the top five mentioned names across 500 newspapers in Black America. You know, this is why this conversation and this topic is so hard, because the perspective of where you look at it is so much mm-hmm. defined in the color of your skin. And when we say skin and race doesn't matter, it's just hard for me to understand how that could be when you look at the generational collateral and the level of opportunity that people got solely and wholly based on their skin color for such a large amount of time, particularly around World War II.
You know, in this last section, I don't know what your broad thoughts are on the U.S. military as an institution, but just reading, especially the early 1900s period, you know, a lot of folks in this audience will know that the U.S. military has just a long-term issue with like recruitment and retention. I think aside from very obvious like racism aspect, I think the U.S. military as a model for what meritocratic advancement and opportunity granting could offer, I think comes ahead from this book, in the sense that you have this family, a general gives the opportunity to get the first job and then like work in the department in the federal government. Then you have the ability through the reading and writing to become an officer. You then have like the next 30, 40, 50 years. It just seems to me that this story that you're telling here, if you can kind of scale it to the modern era and remove obviously like the very literal racist structures, I think this is a story, but I think the U.S. military would want to tell about itself, in the sense that like today we've learned our lessons. And hey, if you're like a struggling kid who wants opportunity, wants education, wants advancement, wants to be treated fairly, like we could be that place. So I think a lot about like the retention recruitment issues. There's like a gem of something really inspirational and valuable here that we a century later can do the right way.
You know, when I went back to West Point for the first time, you know, our family, since Ben had graduated in 1936, he went back in 1986 for his 50-year anniversary. and didn't return back to campus again. We never spoke negatively about West Point. We never spoke positive about it. We just didn't say it. We just didn't have any thought about it at all. In 2015, I set a Google alert after the Red Tails movie in 2012. And in 2015, it went off because there was a proposal on the table that West Point was going to rename and dedicate, not rename, but name and dedicate their largest barrack after a graduating general of West Point. And the options were William Westmoreland, commander of World War II Allied forces, Norman Schwarzkopf, Desert Storm and Desert Shield commander, and many other things as well, general. And then General Benjamin O. Davis Jr. When I went up to the campus to represent Ben in the meeting where they were looking to decide which person to name it after, I don't know if other families went up there. You know, I don't know if they had meetings with them. I'm not sure of the whole process. But I can tell you, I went up there and I told them the story that I'm telling you in this book. And at the end of that process, General Caslin, who was the superintendent at that time, looked at the situation like you looked at it. That was then, and I will prove to you and show to you that now is a different time, not only through the actions that we take on campus with our cadets, but also through the validation that we will give to this story by naming the largest, most expensive barrack in the middle of the campus after the man who lived through this story. So you're exactly on point. And that to me was gratitude from my dad, who cried that Ben would never believe that this happened, because it was such a definitive acknowledgement of yesterday as a way to move to tomorrow, that the military is in fact an unbelievable place to continue your career. And I feel like they have evolved in many ways. They continue to evolve, and we are the ones that have to evolve it. These institutions are all made of people, and those people have feelings, thoughts, emotions. They have biases, they have preferences. They all make up the whole. And those are the people like you and me, maybe our children one day, maybe nephews and nieces, maybe our uncles and aunts. But we're the ones that have to change that policy through performance and through using the system to diffuse the system if we see something that we feel isn't equitable in today's day and time.
I will say, I have to do a quick fact check on you because it's relevant to my reaction to the story you just told. William Westmoreland was the commanding general of American forces in Vietnam, not World War II.
So from
my perspective, what's complicated is he was superintendent of West Point, commanded U.S. forces in Vietnam, did a horrible job. There's actually a couple of books about how bad of a job he did. And then he famously is kicked upstairs to be Army Chief of Staff during the Nixon administration. So yeah, I think if you're William Westmoreland, he had a complicated career. But I think if we had to choose, and you know, bless Storman Norman Schwarzkopf, I think that was like the Desert Storm nickname. The reason why I think this was just a correct decision is I just think that if we're looking at this history, we're looking what had to be overcome, and the sheer bravery of being in an institution, I think that's a very deserving award. So to wrap here, I am curious. This is your first book. You've told a story here. I'm not saying you need to have like your next book in you right now, but what's like another story that you find yourself like interested in, like kind of like drawn towards, given that how personal like this one was?
You know, just yesterday, somebody asked me, you know, I was on the Daily Show yesterday. When I walked off stage, the first question someone asked me is, what do you want your next book to be? So I think naturally I would... I had the opportunity in the last few years to travel around the world to 40 different countries to understand what is equity, what is equality, what is fairness, what is diversity, what is inclusion in 40 different countries. And this was something that opened my eyes going to China or Singapore, going to South Africa, going to Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Then you go to the European countries. I think I would like to do a book similar to the culture map, but around what is diversity around the world. Because I think until we understand that there's 195 countries, until we understand there's 44 countries in Europe, 27 in the EU, you know, 54 in the African continent, 23 in North America, because Central America is part of North America from a landmass. We just don't know the information about the world, and we blurt out things when people walk in. We have stereotypes, we have assumptions about people. And I would like to continue to teach the world and educate even myself through the learning process, how we can be better global citizens and how we can use all of these differences as a superpower and to bring us together rather than something divisive to separate us. So I don't know exactly what I would do with that book, but I end Invisible Generals talking about how Ben just wanted to be called an American, mm-hmm. and how he didn't want to be an African-American. He would accept Black American, but he didn't love it. He hated Negro American and all the other names he was called. And I think there's something very interesting to me, and I think many others, that we like diversity when it comes to food, when it comes to dating, when it comes to, you know, vacations, but when it comes to your asset portfolio folder, when it comes to your career, but when it comes to culture, there's something inherently that tries to separate people instead of bring them together. And I think in the next book, I would like to cover that.
Okay. So last quick question for you.
I know that was a long answer.
No. But like that's what I was, you know, gave me a actually wrapping follow-up here. Okay. Here's the not pushback, right? And that's an interesting book idea, but my initial bit of pushback is America is just like the most inherently diverse mm-hmm. society on earth. I'd be curious what a lot of these other countries have to teach us about diversity, when in fact, I'd actually argue the United States probably has much more to teach other countries about diversity than the other way around. Like, for example, like take Japan. You know, Japan is a country that by its very nature is deeply racialized. They don't accept immigrants to be Japanese. Like, even if you're a Korean migrant who's been there for a century, you're still Korean. You're not Japanese. So in that case, obviously diversity means something very, very specific. But considering the, you know, rapid decline of the Japanese population, they're going to have to think much more, or have at least debates that look like America's debates a century ago, then we're going to have debates about what it looks like to be in Japan. I think the same thing applies to, you know, China, obviously not at a birth rate level, but at a broad, like navigating fractious societies, obviously like the Saudis and the Gulf states have huge problems with South Asian migrant laborers. So you don't have to like answer this, but like, this is why this is an interesting idea, because it actually kind of goes a bunch of different directions that don't lead places that you would essentially think so. So I want to just like offer a prospect and encourage you to go down that path.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I like this, you know, this is the podcast, you know, like I would love to keep talking about this, because my experience is I had a Western bias when looking and observing these other countries. But if you spend time there through immersion, you find many different nuances that countries bring and offer that only the local citizens notice or know of. Okay. And I think if we learned a little bit, and not to say a callous, curt way, but my mom used to say to me, sometimes, Doug, you have to take the best and leave the rest, but always be positive. Mm-hmm. And I think if we looked at all of the different countries and we wanted to become truly global citizens, we could learn from all the cultures and we can understand how all those differences help make all of us stronger on earth. And it may be a little bit, you know, aspirational and you know, ridiculously achievable. But I just think that when you talk about difference, the first thing is to embrace it understand it, partner with it, and you get a lot farther together with all of the differences in the world than we get to apart. But sometimes, like we started this conversation, the systems don't allow the horizontal movement in a vertically driven economy. So I think that that would be the way I would bridge the countries. I would argue America is the most diverse in one singular country, but you can learn from the other countries, similar to how Ben Jr. traveled around the world, Ben Sr. traveled around the world, I've traveled around the world. It sounds like you've traveled around the world. You have a different perspective when you've lived an experience and you understand what these cultures can provide. And together we're so much stronger, but we have to be able to be open.
That is an excellent place to leave things. The book is Invisible Generals. It's available in the show's book notes. And this has been really great. Thank you for joining me on
Thank
the
you so
show,
much,
Doug.
Marshall. I appreciate you so much. And good luck to you in the future. And thank you for your listeners for giving me, for them allowing me an hour of their life.